Back at it with you Monday, November 30th, final day of November 2020 on Connecticut Today. In the 3 o'clock hour, we spoke with one of our go-to guys, Dr. Gary Rose, about how Joe Biden is laying out his prospective cabinet. 4 o'clock hour, the latest comments on the coronavirus response in Connecticut by Governor Ned Lamont. In the 5 o'clock hour, we tackled, with a guess, another possible gas tax hike, a different type of tax, though, here in Connecticut. And I had some thoughts about where we're going with taxes like that to wrap up the show. Dr. Gary Rose, chair of the Department of Government at Sacred Heart University. Gary, how are you? Hope all is well.
Yeah, I'm doing well, Paul. Hope all is well with you, too.
You're still teaching from home, right? Still doing the Zoom classes at Sacred Heart?
Yeah, still on Zoom, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, getting it done. It's somewhat impersonal, obviously, but yeah. it's manageable.
Yeah, good. As long as you're not getting Zoom bombed, that could be a...
No.
That could be... No. Use your passwords, use your security
right, exactly.
Settings.
Yeah.
So, Gary, we're seeing here in the last few days, Joe Biden... naming his cabinet picks, and, you know, this, I guess, sounds like what people thought it would be, Gary, a combination of a lot of names that we heard from the Clinton years and from the Obama years.
Yeah, very much so. There's nothing really exciting about the individuals who are being chosen. They are very experienced government administrators, many of whom have had close associations with President-elect Biden and the Clinton administration, as you mentioned. And I think we're in for a what appears to be a fairly I'm going to be a little careful here about, you know, saying mundane, but probably a not a terribly charismatic group of individuals in the cabinet who are really just professional administrators, somewhat boring. It's going to be somewhat dry, and it's going to be reminiscent, I think, of some previous administrations that we've had.
And I'm guessing, Gary, that about half the country is going to say, okay, I'm okay with boring and dry after, yeah, you know, 4+ years. I don't think, you know, there's a method to that madness there. I think there is.
Yeah, in many ways, you know, I think that this election was reminiscent of the 1920 election, where Warren Harding campaigned on a return to normalcy, and in some respects, that's what I think a good portion of the voters were looking for. You know, there's been so much turmoil, so much controversy associated with the president, and I do believe a lot of voters that even voted for Biden, you know, still appreciate some of the things that Donald Trump has accomplished during his time in office. But at the same time, I think they're pretty tired of the of all the vitriol that's going on, you know, that comes out of the White House and on Twitter and so forth. And people, I think, might be okay for at least for the next 4 years for somewhat of a boring administration. And I think, quite frankly, looking at the individuals who are chosen for these cabinet posts and within the White House staff, I think that's really what we're going to get, somewhat centrist, you know, professional administrators.
Gary, hang on. We'll be right back with you getting the post-election shakedown here from Dr. Gary Rose, chairman and professor in the Department of Government at Sacred Heart University. Gary, back with you momentarily. Traffic and weather together. A little bit of a nasty day out there, folks. Slow it down. Two hands on the wheel. Right here, 3:36 on WICC. And a few more minutes with one of our go-to guys on politics, local and national, chair of the Department of Government at Sacred Heart University, Dr. Gary Rose. You know, Gary, I have a lot of people to call this show friends, relatives, who ask me all the time, how was it that, yeah, Joe Biden got a boatload of votes, but Donald Trump got over 70 million votes? I mean, the turnout from, you know, mail-in voting was amazing. But I have a lot of people who can't understand that if the president lost, how is it that the Republicans are going to gain in the low double figures in House seats and likely hold on to the Senate? Do you think, Gary, there was just some old-fashioned ticket splitting going on out there?
You know, that's very interesting you ask that question, because in political science, all of the research in recent decades shows a tremendous rise in straight ticket voting. And this time around, it appears that a good number of voters were just not willing to, to support Trump, yet at the same time, they were willing to vote for some of these Republican candidates in districts. And so there were districts where Trump did not do well, and in states too, yet Republican in the down ticket actually, you know, did very well. And so it does show that sometimes when you have such a controversial individual at the top of the ticket, that some voters are more than willing to split. And that did surprise me. I mean, I think when in all is said and done, we're still going to find a pretty high percentage of straight ticket voting, but certainly what you mentioned with the gains in the House, yes, and also, you know, holding on to the Senate, for at least it looks that way right now, although we'll know more in January. Some voters were certainly willing to go with Republican congressional candidates, but not the president.
And I saw there was a survey from the Harris survey people, Gary, who are now hooked in with The Hill and Harvard University. They came out with a survey last week that said 55% of Americans want the Republicans to control the Senate. So, you know, there may be gridlock, but I think people like gridlock sometimes.
Well, I think they do. And, you know, in political science, sometimes we refer to the electorate as inherently Madisonian.
Yeah.
And, you know, James Madison is the one who wanted separation of powers and checks and balances. And at times it does seem like the American people get a little squeamish about having a trifecta down in Washington where one party is in control of both the White House and both chambers of Congress. And so I think we're seeing that possibly at work here with the number of Republicans who won in the House races, and a good number of Republican women too, which is very interesting. And then what we have going on with the Senate race too, I think there's a strong chance that the Republicans will hold on to that chamber too. So it does seem like the American people sometimes, I don't know if they really favor gridlock, although I've heard that, but they certainly favor deliberation, and they appreciate government to move slowly at times.
Well, as you say, Gary, there are a lot of founders, and I've done a good amount of reading about this. They wanted change to be slow, right? To be very deliberate. They didn't want, you know, a change to be at the drop of a hat or at the snap of a wrist. They didn't want that.
They never did. The founding fathers believed in very deliberative government that should move slowly. And furthermore, they wanted limited government, which is, of course, inherent in the Constitution itself. And so when we see just what we're talking about here, Republicans doing well on the down ticket, it's evident that the spirit of Madisonianism is certainly still alive and well in American politics.
A little closer to home, Gary, here in Connecticut. I think as in the previous cycle, you saw the Republicans hurt by some seats in what's obviously an anti-Trump push here. In the state, they lost a couple of more seats in the Senate, handful of more seats in the House, although the president, obviously because of the turnout, got a higher amount of votes here than he did in 2016.
Yeah.
But, boy, I got to tell you, if you're a Republican in Connecticut here, Gary, in the General Assembly, in the House or Senate, I mean, I know they work their tails off, but, boy, what do you do?
Well,
I mean, and there's a lot of good Democrats, a lot of good Republicans out there, but, you know, I get people who call me all the time saying, you know, this is a one-party state. How do we change it? I don't know how you do that.
Yeah. Well, you know, everything I said about Madisonianism does not apply in Connecticut. So that goes right out the window if we want to focus in on our own state.
In fact, James Madison said in his writings, I prefer this, except the fine state of Connecticut, yes.
Yeah,
and my good friend Roger Sherman, yes.
That's right. But the demographics of Connecticut have been changing, and certainly much to the advantage of the Democratic Party. And as you mentioned, the Republican Party is now down to about 20%, 21% of the state's electorate, and struggling to be relevant. And it's, you know, we have had some success with electing Republican governors, but even now that's even more difficult given the voter registration figures and the movement of the state toward in the Democratic column. And so the state legislature, as you mentioned, I mean, the federal races, the federal offices, all yeah. occupied by Democrats, the governor's office, occupied by a Democrat. It's just a trifecta plus, you know, around here with the Democrats. And so it's tough to be a Connecticut Republican. And it was not that long ago, interestingly enough, when we not only had Republican governors, but we had three members of Congress
yeah.
who were Republican also. But this state has seen a marked shift really towards the liberal side of the political spectrum in the last decade or so.
Finally, on the local side and on the national side, is mail-in voting here to stay in the federal years? What do you think?
Yeah, well, I read in the paper this morning that it certainly looks as if it's going to be a permanent feature here, certainly in Connecticut elections. And, I think that it is to the advantage, quite frankly, of the Democrats. And not surprisingly, Denise Merrill, our Secretary of State, and a whole range of lawmakers want to keep this trend going. The Republicans do benefit from in-person voting, but when it comes to mail-in voting, that does tend to favor the Democrats. So not surprisingly, we're going to see that. I wouldn't be too surprised, too, Paul, if we see not just mail-in voting, but also early voting, too. I think yeah. that's going to happen, too.
I mean, I'm okay with that, Gary. I mean, a couple of weeks out. But you have some of these states, Gary, that were voting 6 weeks out.
I know.
Supposing that, I've always called it, Gary, honestly, for either side, to me, it's a candidate protection program. You vote for somebody 6 weeks out, and what happens 3 weeks later if they find bags of cash in their car?
I know. Yeah, and we had people voting in this last election, not in Connecticut, but in other states, even, you know, before the presidential debates were over. And how can you really draw a conclusion sometimes without seeing the voters go, the candidates go toe-to-toe? And so that's why I do have some issues with early voting, certainly. And I wouldn't be surprised if that comes down the pike. And then we might even see other forms of voting, too, like drive-by voting. I know that Texas had that recently where people can pull up in cars and just vote, kind of like you're going to McDonald's and stuff. And so it's getting easier and easier. We've lowered barriers. It seems like we lower the barriers, increasingly. If you want to call them barriers, I'm not even sure they are barriers.
No.
But nevertheless, we're making voting almost like an entitlement. That's really what it's coming down to. And that does concern me a little bit. It seems to diminish, quite frankly, the meaning of an election day.
Well, thank you. Because, I mean, Gary, look, when you and I, we became of age, we both went down to City Hall or Town Hall. We raised our right hand. We signed it. And that was it. I am constantly, Gary, finally, and not besmirching anybody's right to vote, but I am just constantly amazed, Gary, at how often we have to beg and plead people to register to vote. I mean, we did it when we were in high school.
I know. Yeah, well, we went to Election Day registration, too, so that, too, makes it easier to just get up in the morning someday and decide you're going to be a voter without previous registration. And so you got to wonder if there are any barriers at all, or any types of hoops you have to jump over. And, I talk about this with my students all the time, and young persons think that voting should be just essentially, as easy and as automatic as possible. And I guess sometimes I show my age when I say, well, there are such things as rights with responsibilities.
Thank you.
There really are.
Dr. Gary Rose, chair of the Department of Government at Sacred Heart University. Always great to hear from you, Gary. Thank you. We'll talk down the road. Okay. Appreciate it.
All right, Paul. All right. Take care.
Thanks, Gary. Appreciate it. Dr. Gary Rose, professor and chair of the Government Department of Sacred Heart University. Go Pioneer.
4.4% positivity is interesting in the sense that it's another day that's not going up, in fact, going down a little bit. And we were about 4.7% over the last week, so you can see it's been going down over a week. We were at 5.8% probably a couple of weeks ago. So let's watch the trend line, but that is hopeful. Unfortunately, hospitalizations and fatalities are lagging indicators. And so while positivity is going down, hospitalizations continues to go up. I'd like to see that number going down over the next couple of weeks, and then we'll know that we have something really to be thankful for. fatalities, 59 more people have died due to COVID. I think you see that total number, 5,020. So that's a big number of people who have died over the last 8 months with COVID-related deaths. We have heart disease, we have cancer, and we have COVID in 2020. And these are all members of our family, generally not kids, but their parents and grandparents. And we'll miss them dearly. Next chart, cheer you up a little bit, is hospitalizations and test positivity. That line I told you about, the yellow dotted line there, that's the 7-day average. So we watch that number. It is trending down over a short period of time. And frankly, some of our neighbors are going up, so we have to watch this. The blue line, on the other hand, is the number of people in the hospital. And so you see that number continues to go up with COVID-related beds being filled. Nowhere near where we were back 7 months ago, but still a number to keep an eye on. Hopefully that number will trend down following the testing positivity. This next chart, very colorful, isn't it? Test positivity compared to our other states. I can cut to the chase here. Green is the best, and that's Vermont, and that is Hawaii. But still don't go to Hawaii for Christmas, but it's worth noting. The lighter the color, the better off you are. Those in the yellow, that's Connecticut, and our neighbors like New York and Maine, at less than 5%. You can see Idaho and South Dakota, they're north of 30%. Just to give you a little perspective of how we are dispersing a bit right now as a country. I guess Washington State, I don't know what they're doing. They're still counting the numbers up there. But this gives you a little idea of where Connecticut stacks up. We're still, you know, probably the fifth or sixth lowest in the country, which is good, and we got to follow those trends. That said, I was sort of interested reading the headlines today, so Josh and Max put this together. What do we do going forward? As you see these trends lines, you see hospitalizations going up, positivity going down, different states doing different things. Dozens of Connecticut doctors have asked us to close the gyms, close down indoor dining. Let's get a lot more severe. Others say, no, gosh, you got to leave the gyms open. You got to leave indoor dining open. It's important for our mental health. It's important for our economic health. I would just say, looking at the numbers for this past weekend, the Thanksgiving weekend, and November in general, you don't have to do a lot by fiat. The people of Connecticut continue, I think, to do the right thing. I worried a lot about people, excess travel over Thanksgiving. We're not going to know the results of Thanksgiving for another week or two, but we do know that rail travel here on Metro North down 85%. We know that driving down about 30%. And this is not corporate related. It's not going to work related. These were, Thanksgiving related. I can tell you people talk about the restaurants and close the restaurants, open the restaurants. The restaurants worked really hard to stay open and do it safely. It's sort of interesting. Dave Lehman took a look at an open table, which is the online ordering, to give a snapshot of what's going on. And let's say restaurants were down 3% September 20 to September 2019. Restaurants were down 18% October over October. And restaurants were down 43% November over November. Maybe that's a little bit related to weather. Maybe that's related to people staying closer to home. I say that in the sense that we don't have to do everything by fiat. In many cases, people tend to do what they feel comfortable with, and that's what keeps them safe. And I also urge you to order online and do everything you can to support our restaurants and for takeout and pickup. A similar situation in retail. We thought a lot about Black Friday and Cyber Monday today. It's worth remembering that from the national numbers, retail was down probably 50% on Black Friday. And Online shopping is up about 20%. And again, I urge you, I remind you, buy local. You can buy local online. You can do it for pickup, some of it for delivery. It's worth helping out your local merchants. They need it a lot. That's one way you can help. So it's less about what you close and open and more about what you can do in terms of your personal behavior, which I think makes by far the biggest difference. Gatherings, keep them small. Immediate family is safest, 10 maximum. Okay, got a little tight there at Thanksgiving. I appreciate that, but it does make an enormous difference. Over 65, Ned, practice what you preach, but stay safe, stay at home. You are the most vulnerable, and that age group, 65 and above, are the ones most likely to end up in a hospital. We're doing everything we can to keep you safe and hospitalizations down. Maximize takeout, as I said before. Work from home whenever possible. Keep your guard up and wear your mask. I was sort of interested that I just finished up, will probably be one of Vice President Pence's last COVID task force meetings, and we were all on the same page. Everybody was wearing the mask, from the vice president, everybody around the table, and the governors, unless they were speaking. And I could tell you that President Trump and Vice President-elect Biden don't agree on everything, like not much at all, but they agree on the importance of the vaccinations and taking the vaccination, COVID vaccine, when it's safe, when it's effective. They gave us the good news that is rolling out, you know, about Pfizer. Probably by December 14th, we could get our first 20,000 doses of vaccine there. Probably a week later, we'll get another 20,000 doses from Moderna. 95% effective, which Dr. Fauci was on saying, not only is it safe, it's surprisingly effective. So I think it's on Thursday, we'll probably have a Deirdre back on to tell you what our vaccination strategy is. And it only works if people take the vaccine. Next up is Step Up Connecticut, other ways that you can, you know, keep us safe and keep making progress on the vaccine. And we need your help in terms of Step Up Connecticut, in terms of your volunteerism coming forward. We have hundreds of people. We need many hundreds more. We need that to serve patients in our hospitals. We need that to support our testing sites, as we said before. We need that to keep our schools open. I was interested that this weekend, Dr. Fauci was very clear. He said, close the bars, open the schools, and you can do it safely. But somebody who can tell us how we can do that safely is Fran Rabinowitz. Fran, as I mentioned, you know, works with all the superintendents. Just today, she met with 20 superintendents remotely, hearing their urgency, doing everything she can to keep the schools open. Fran, any thoughts?
Thank you, Governor, and thank you for having me here today. You are right. I meet with over 100 superintendents every week and remotely in area meetings. And this afternoon, I met with 20 of them, all of whom are trying their very, very best to keep the schools open, because we know that in-person schooling is so effective for all of our kids, but most especially for our youngest kids and our students with disabilities. I would say that they are trying valiantly, and right now, most of the 20 that I spoke with, all but five were full in at the elementary level. When I say full in, there's always a number of students whose parents choose remote. And they said they are, they're doing really well with the kids, with the mitigating strategies. The teachers are phenomenal. They've learned new strategies. They've adapted well to this environment. We know, they are telling me, that attendance is better when the kids are in person. Sometimes they're hybrid, you know, 2 days in, 2 days off. And those off days, the attendance is not quite as good as it is in person. They're also saying that if they are forced to close, it's not because of transmission of COVID. It's because they do not have enough staff to cover the classrooms while teachers are quarantining because they've been exposed, et cetera, outside of school. So Step Up Connecticut is a perfect opportunity for us to bring in college students and others that can help us out so that the teacher who is the assigned teacher can teach remotely and another volunteer substitute can come in and teach in person. But we do know that that in-person instruction, we've heard from the kids themselves, it's so important for them to have that relationship with the teacher and the relationship with their fellow classmates. It cuts down on the isolation and some of the issues that have arisen in families because of COVID. It helps them greatly to be in school.
Hey, thank you, Fran. And I did notice that New York City closed their schools, and then parents and kids said, hey, at least for the younger grades, we got to be open, and they are reopening.
Yes.
Fran is sticking around, as is Josh and Paul. Any questions?
Channel 3 Eyewitness News.
Good afternoon, everyone. Going back to the halting gym use and indoor dining, is there a specific number or benchmark the state would have to see to even lead to that possibility?
I think I would look at hospitalizations. I'd look at capacity. I'd see if our ICUs and hospital beds and nurses were being overwhelmed. That would probably say, look, we'll do everything we can to mitigate that. But I don't think we're close to that right now. I sure hope not.
Thank you. And one more question. Today, Rhode Island hospitals are at capacity and field hospitals are opening. Because we're so close, obviously, those are our neighbors. Do you have any concerns about that, Governor?
Well, you saw our capacity numbers, so we're doing a little better than Rhode Island at this point, and we can get those field hospitals up pretty quickly, as we've discussed before. So on my list of concerns, I think we can address that and address that on a timely basis if we had to.
Thank you.
NBC Connecticut.
Good afternoon, Governor. You've always said that you lead with science as you made decisions during the pandemic. So when you do receive a letter that, like the one you mentioned off the top, from 35 doctors around the state urging you to close gyms and pause indoor dining and ban social gatherings, how heavily does that weigh on you?
Oh, look, I take that to heart. I'll be talking to the doctors tomorrow. I think Josh helped set that call up. That said, I look around and I see, where are the infections? Are we managing it? Can we bend the curve? Are we doing this in an appropriate way? I could shut down schools, shut down restaurants, lock everything up, and say, let's come back in the new year. But you got to get the right balance going forward. I think we've got a good balance right now, but we can always change course if we have to.
And so if you do feel at some point the necessity to take additional steps, would those suggestions by the doctors, another indoor dining ban or gym closures, be the next logical step?
I think so.
Okay. And then lastly, you mentioned that Deidre will be back on Thursday, but you do have an important ACIC meeting tomorrow to talk about the six vaccination distribution plan. So what can you tell us today about the status of that plan and how tomorrow's meeting will help finalize how the state moves forward?
I can tell you we got to move pretty fast. We are going to get vaccines. We are going to get it before the end of the year, middle of December. December 14th is a date they're hoping for Pfizer. We've worked very hard with CVS and Walgreens, making sure that they have the distribution in place, focused on nursing homes, and we also can get that out to the hospitals. So my understanding from Deirdre and Reg is that's our near-term priority, and hopefully we'll be able to get that addressed pretty thoroughly over the course of the first month or so.
Thanks for your time.
News 8.
Good afternoon, everyone. Governor, you mentioned the hospitalizations as being kind of that next metric in moving forward now. So I guess what you're saying is we're not really close to it, despite what the healthcare people have indicated. Would you try and be proactive? You mentioned those, having those other facilities set up in advance for more hospitalizations. Is that kind of the next step to what you can do to be proactive?
I think that would be a next step. As we've said, though, we can do that on relatively short order. We haven't had any of the hospitals that I know of ask us for that as yet. But we got the Connecticut Guard and General Yvonne ready, standing by if we need to.
I think two other important points on this topic. The governor's mentioned many times that the first challenge we'll likely run into would be staff, right? Doctors, nurses, the professionals who serve patients and who are on the front lines. That would be the first area we would likely see challenges, not necessarily physical capacity, but from a physical bed space perspective. Recall as well that all of our hospitals are still performing all of their regular procedures, attending to the medical needs of the citizens of Connecticut that come up independent of COVID every day. And that's critically important too, because when we delayed care earlier in the spring, that had impacts for people as well. So we're hoping to avoid that, but if pushed, there are procedures that the hospitals would start to curtail and continue to use the beds they have in their hospitals before we get to the field hospital setup. So we're not into that phase yet. Hopefully we don't get there, but hopefully we don't need to use those field hospitals this time around.
All right. I haven't spoken to this gentleman in a while, and I know that when his folks contact me, it's something serious. And we're going to talk about the Transportation Climate Initiative. And I remember when this came up a few months ago, and I went, here we go. Chris Herb joins us. Chris is president of CEMA, the Connecticut Energy Marketers Association. Chris, it's been a while. Paul Pacelli, how are you, sir?
Oh, I'm doing, aside from this, pretty good.
You mean to tell me you've got agita over this, Chris? What's
I could use stronger language, but this is radio, so we'll be kind. Yes, I have agita.
And if you slip, we do have a 10-second delay, so my producer will catch it. You know, Chris, I remember when this first came up, I went, oh, here we go. And it died down a little, but now this Transportation Climate Initiative, Chris, I guess is bubbling up again. What is this, and why are you folks at the Connecticut Energy Marketers Association so concerned? Explain this to my audience.
Sure. Well, just like your traffic report said that traffic is ugly slow, well, this is going to be ugly expensive. I'll just start by saying that. First of all, just a little background for your listeners. We represent folks who are involved in the sale of motor fuel, so sort of your typical gas station, convenience store in Connecticut. Those are family-owned businesses. They are not owned by the Shells and the Mobils and the Exxons. These are local family-owned businesses. We have a state law that prohibits those big companies from owning them, so we're the ones who you do business with every day, and that's why we are particularly concerned about this Transportation Climate Initiative, or they're calling it TCI. Basically what it is it's a very expensive climate curbing plan to try to lower emissions from the transportation sector. So every car and truck that passes over the roads is going to end up paying to aspirationally lower emissions. And, you know, I don't know about you, but I'm not sure how a tax ends up lowering emissions. That math doesn't quite work for me.
So what is their logic? In other words, if I was sitting here, Chris, with you and somebody who's for this, some of the people generating this idea, what would they say if you and I got together and said, wait a minute, how does a tax here end up helping us be more green or more environmentally friendly? What would they say? What have they been telling you?
Sure. Well, they wouldn't use these words, but I'll kind of describe a bit from my very. I'm a simple person, so I have to understand things simply. And some of the most effective ways to curb people's activities is through sin taxes. So, for instance, everyone's aware of smokers, right? The cigarette tax is designed to have people smoke less, right? Smoking is considered a sin by the government, so they figure if we tax it more, people will smoke less. And they've been particularly right. The difference is that taking that mentality and applying it to emissions from cars and trucks doesn't work. And there's clear evidence throughout the decades that certainly show that the higher gasoline prices go, it does not change behavior. You don't drive less, because guess what? Most of us, we're just driving to work, we're driving to church,
yeah,
we're driving our kids to soccer practice. There, we don't go on the Sunday fun drive through the country anymore. We do what is necessary to support our families and our family activities. And unfortunately, this program, what they would say is that they plan on taxing gasoline and diesel fuel, and they plan on increasing that tax every year to try to send signals to the consumer to use less of it. But because gasoline is inelastic, people will continue to drive regardless of how much it costs. So this sin tax is going to be ultimately, in our assessment, ineffective. It will punish our customers, and it will hurt Connecticut's economy when we can least afford to be hurt even more than we have through by COVID.
Now, Chris Herb, a lot of our listeners will be saying to themselves as they listen to you and I, well, wait a minute. Don't we already pay gas taxes up the wazoo in this state? Where is this coming from? What would you tell them? I mean, where did this come from, Chris?
Well, they would be correct that right now you pay a federal excise tax, a state excise tax, a petroleum gross earnings tax. So we have three taxes that are currently on every gallon of gasoline and diesel fuel. And those range, because one of them is a percentage tax, they can move up and down, but they range anywhere from 60 to 70 cents a gallon. This isn't Connecticut per se. This isn't the federal government. What this is, it's a new group of regional states that are being asked to pull together and to add a regional tax on top of your state and federal taxes. So again, it's not something that we've ever seen before in the transportation side. The closest thing to it is in the electricity sector, which, since Connecticut consumers already pay the highest electric rates nearly in the country, well, guess what? They've taken that good idea that just drove up electricity prices, and frankly, I haven't used less electricity because my rates have gone up, and now they're applying it to the transportation sector and the cars that the people who are probably listening to your program right now are paying those taxes and will pay these new taxes.
Chris, hang on. We'll be back with more from you. Chris Herb is the guest. He's the president. He heads the Connecticut Energy Marketers Association, talking about, ding, 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 guess what, folks? More taxes, maybe, if the state goes with this compact with other states. It's called the Transportation Climate Initiative. Chris, hang on. Traffic and weather together. Speaking of cars, 516 on the sixes here on WICC. And we're trying to warn you of a new gasoline tax. Chris Herb is president of the Connecticut Energy Marketers Association. And folks, you may remember I talked about this months and months ago when this first came up, the Transportation Climate Initiative. Initiative is always fun language. It's always it's a great Scrabble word, Chris, for getting people to do something that's good. A lot of points there, you know, a lot of good tiles. To get them to agree to something that they really don't want to do, but they may be forced into doing it. Now, Chris, where would this tax that supposedly would go to all things environmental and wonderful, where would this tax be applied? The retailer, the wholesaler, the middleman, where is this going to be applied?
Sure, it's applied in the very same place that the Connecticut petroleum gross earnings tax is assessed, which is upstream from the consumer. It's not a pump tax. It happens at the wholesale level. So in the way that the petroleum gross earnings tax works, because that's the closest thing that we have to this proposal, is that the wholesaler pays the tax, passes it down to the retailer, who passes it on to the motorist. So if you're driving a car, you're not avoiding that tax just because it's being assessed upstream from you. It is paid ultimately at the pump, even though it's assessed at the wholesale level.
So the next question, obviously, is you and your association, have you made your displeasure in this known to General Assembly members? Does the General Assembly have any say in this? Is this something the governor, Chris, could do by fiat? How does this work?
sir, we certainly hope so. So we did. We have been engaged in a number of processes where this this initiative, this new tax, this sin tax, is being discussed. One of those is the Governor's Council on Climate Change, which recently recommended that the state enter into a multi-state program just like this one. So we fought the battle there, where the Department of Energy and Environmental Protection, the governor's folks who deal with these issues on his behalf, were looking at this. So we made it clear there. We've sent a letter to the governor. You mentioned to your listeners that you brought this up several months ago, and at that time the governor was did not seem to be eager to pursue this program. Part of the reason why we've kind of reignited our concerns, number one, is because these are our customers. We're the ones who have to look across the counter at you and mm-hmm. explain why the price of gasoline just went up. And just to kind of give everybody an idea, because real numbers count here, when this tax is fully implemented, according to a Tufts University study that came out a week and a half ago, it will be calculated at an additional 61 cents per gallon. That's Tufts calculates that is that could be the maximum that the tax will calculate at. That's $1 billion in revenue to the state of Connecticut. So to your specific question, you know, can the governor just do this? And I think that there's a little disagreement amongst the way our group sees it, the people who are actually selling you the gasoline and some people who would like to see this go forward. Some believe that the governor can just sign on to a memorandum of understanding, which we believe will be released in the next week or two. And that's of a huge concern to us, because without really having a statewide conversation about this, you don't want the governor to make that decision without ample input. So our letter and what we've been doing to this point is urging that the legislature should have to take an affirmative vote before one penny of new taxes can be put onto the consumers of Connecticut, because we believe that this new legislature that was elected will be responsible enough to not let this go forward.
You're assuming, Chris, though, that the legislators we talk about have guts.
You know what? When they hear, when their constituents hear that in the final year that the Tufts University study is showing that this could cost as much as 61 cents per gallon, I think that, you know, it's going to be more about fear of not being reelected than guts to oppose this.
And Chris, you and I both know, because I've done numerous shows on this, any increase in gasoline tax, it's kind of like when you go to somebody's house, like for the holidays, and you gorge yourself on the hors d'oeuvres, but you're so full that you can't really eat the main course, because any gasoline tax increases, they're almost self-defeating, because cars are getting more and more gas efficient, those who still buy gasoline powered cars, the vast, vast majority. And then there's going to be this gradual move to hybrids. So what happens when the curve starts going the other way, Chris, and this font of money starts to dry up?
Well, theoretically, I think you're correct. If this were to work, and again, I don't think it will work. I think that the only people who will benefit from this are the wealthy. What the tax, part of the purpose of the tax is to generate a pool of money to potentially discount the cost of an electric vehicle. So low and middle income families, those people working at Sikorsky, you know, your neighbor who's struggling paycheck to paycheck, they will pay more in these taxes to subsidize wealthy guys purchasing electric vehicles, and those electric vehicles won't pay road taxes. So I think that the history that has shown us that the market is inelastic, people will have to continue to drive to work, to soccer practice, and to church, is not going to change that much. But if theoretically it did, you're right. Then what will end up happening is that it won't generate the tax and they won't have the incentives to do this. That's why they need to find another way to lower emissions, not by punishing low and middle income families.
Yeah, I mean, listen, God bless anybody. I know a couple of guys in my town here who have, you know, the top of the line Tesla. That's a gorgeous car, but it's a $75,000, $80,000 car, Chris. I don't know. You and I, we don't see, they're nice cars, but we don't see a heck of a lot of them on the road for a reason of simple economics. Chris, listen, it's been fabulous. Chris Herb, president of the Connecticut Energy Marketers Association, folks, pay attention. Pay attention. This is the Transportation Climate Initiative. Chris, where can folks get more information about this and about your organization?
Sure. They can go to our website, which is CTEMA.com. Lots of information there on this, and as the winter approaches, a lot of information on heating fuel. So we'll be there to help your listeners in any way we can.
Great. CTEMA.com, CTEMA.com, the Connecticut Energy Marketers Association. Chris Herb, Chris, good to talk with you. Let's keep in touch, especially if something happens on this in the next few weeks. Chris, good to talk to you. Be good.
Paul, thank you very much.
Appreciate it. Chris Herb, president of the Connecticut Energy Marketers Association, CTEMA.com. So will the governor reject the Transportation Climate Initiative? I love it. I love that word. It's great. It's it. We have an initiative. No, you want to raise taxes. Yes, but it's an initiative for cleaner modes of transportation. Oh, God. We take it in the shorts in this state over and over. And, oh, it's only this. It's only 2 or 3 cents a gallon. Blank you, it's only this. Don't you hate that? Unreal. Connecticut would join into a regional plan that would raise gas prices to pay for what's being sold as cleaner transportation. Under TCI, low and middle income families who typically can't afford electric cars would pay more in gasoline taxes, and those wealthy enough would afford the electric cars, they would pay no additional tax. So think about that. You got a lot of people, and God bless them, if you drive a, you know, any sort and any number of the electric hybrids out there, God bless you. I think the technology is great. It's wonderful. Within 10, 20, 30, 40 years, the majority of cars on the road will be electric, likely. I can't, you know, say that for certain. But again, as the natural progression of technology goes in this country, it's driven largely by people wanting to move up to the next thing, right? And there are enough hybrids or gas electric hybrids or all electric hybrids now that are kind of sort of affordable to the, you know, regular middle income folks. I suspect they'll get a little cheaper in the next few years. Price is a point for everything, folks. So in the first year alone, Tufts University saying Connecticut people who use gasoline and not electricity would have to fork over $665 million more in year one. Why not? As my father used to say, easy come, easy go, kid. You got it, spend it. Governor Lamont said at a recent news conference that TCI is something the state legislature should be thinking about. And again, one-party state, there's no real opposition to this. Now, of course, I expect the fine men and women who wear the Republican mantle in this state will object to it, and nobody will care. Oh, well, too much. Too bad. There you go, right in the shorts again. Oh, man, you can't wait. It, you know what? It's never enough. The money, the taxes that we're asked to fork over, it's never enough. And I'll say this again over and over and over and over and over again. I don't care how unfair people think this is. Before you start gouging the gas taxes again, before you start putting tolls back in again, before you start raising fees for this again, you want money for the environment? You want money for infrastructure? I'm sorry, raise the sales tax. Keep the gas tax where it is. Raise the sales tax. Well, that's not fair, Paul, if people don't use the roads. No, but you know what? Again, you want to give me that argument? I'll give you the argument right back. What about people who say, I don't have kids in a local school system? Why am I paying taxes in part to fund my local school system when my kids are grown or I don't have kids or I'm single or whatever? My kids live in another part of the world, whatever. Why am I doing that? Well, it's for the greater good. There is a reason with local property taxes, we don't charge different rates if you're under 65 generally. We don't charge different rates if you have kids or don't have kids, or if you have one kid or two kids and no kids. Well, the same should work for all these environmental taxes and transportation taxes. Everybody pays. Everybody. So instead of putting in tolls and say, well, the drivers are going to pay. No, everybody pays. Good roads, good infrastructure, doesn't that benefit everyone in the state, not just drivers? Just the way a good school system, well-educated kids in a city or town benefit everyone in that city or town, not just people with kids? Well, shouldn't we take it the same way as to say everybody can fork over a little bit more in sales tax, maybe another half penny or a penny, to see what that does for the roads and the bridges and the environment? 203-333-9422, 333-WYCC. And, you know, none of this has to be permanent. That's another thing that kills me. When we talk about these issues of raising taxes or fees, and if we go nuts that if we pass something or want to try something, it's got to be there forever. No. Put sunset clauses in this stuff. You know, after a certain date of next year, it goes away unless it's reauthorized by the General Assembly. The problem is that the majority of people in the General Assembly don't have the huevos, the huliones, the agates, as my father used to say, to vote up or down on this. Well, the governor may sign a memorandum of understanding. What? What? Excuse me? A memorandum of understanding. I'll try that with the IRS. See how that works. See, you don't understand. I have a memorandum of understanding that I don't have to pay this tax. Yeah. Right away, kid.